Good evening.
A progressive activist passes. We hear from a loved one, a soldier on Trump and his slurs against the military. And Julian Assange has his day in court. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Tuesday, September 8th, 2020. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he'll force a vote on a GOP coronavirus relief package after weeks of closed-door talks between Republican senators and the White House. The Republican bill is expected to include a federal unemployment benefit, another round of Paycheck Protection Program funding, and more money for coronavirus testing and schools, as well as liability protection from lawsuits related to the virus. McConnell didn't release a price tag for the forthcoming bill, but it's expected to be at least $500 billion, half of the $1 trillion package Republicans previously unveiled in late July, and a fraction of the $3 trillion package offered by the House-authored HEROES Act. The GOP bill doesn't include Democratic priorities like more money for state and local governments. And according to allies, Belarusian authorities drove prominent opposition leader Maria Kolesnikova to the border with Ukraine on Tuesday, a day after she was snatched from the street in Minsk, but she tore up her passport so they couldn't force her to cross. Kolesnikova has become a key figure during 4 weeks of mass protests against President Alexander Lukashenko. Other opposition leaders also say they were arrested and driven to the border with Kolesnikova. Meanwhile, police detained dozens of people from among hundreds who protested in Minsk against her disappearance, some chanting, "Maria, you are a hero." Belarus has seen a tense political stalemate since the disputed presidential election on August 9th, with protesters flooding the streets and security forces responding with mass arrests. And helicopters flew through dense smoke to rescue more than 200 people from wildfires as wind fan flames kept chewing through bone dry California. It was a scorching Labor Day weekend with temperatures hitting 120 degrees in some locations. California has already set a record with nearly 2.3 million acres burned this year, and the worst part of the wildfire season is just beginning. Over the weekend, the power company cut lines or cut juice to 172,000 customers to try and prevent more blazes. More than 14,000 firefighters are battling more than two dozen fires around the state. The biggest fires are near San Francisco. Officials say one of the fires in San Bernardino County started Saturday morning when fireworks were used by a couple at a party to reveal their baby's gender. Top police leaders in Rochester, New York announced their retirements Tuesday. The resignations come amid nightly protests sparked by the police killing of Daniel Prude 5 months ago. Police Chief LaRon Singletary and Deputy Chief Joseph M. Morabito released email statements confirming their retirements. Mayor Lovely Warren told city council members in an online briefing she believes the entire command staff should have decided to retire. Prude's family filed a federal lawsuit Tuesday alleging the police department sought to cover up the true nature of Prude's death. The lawsuit states Mr. Prude was in the midst of an acute manic psychotic episode. He was unarmed, naked, and suffering. He needed help. Police union officials have said the officers were following their training. And progressive activists in the United States lost a committed soldier in the peace movement over the weekend. Progressive activist Kevin Zeese died from a sudden heart attack Saturday night at his home in Maryland. He was a native of Queens and went to New York City public schools. He graduated from George Washington Law School in 1980. Zeese was a tireless activist and a fighter against the war on drugs. As executive director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in the 1980s and working with Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoke on drug reform in the 1990s. Zeese was an early advocate of free needle exchanges to fight HIV/AIDS. Recently, Zeese was involved with anti-war activism. Together with his partner, Dr. Margaret Flowers, Zeese was part of an occupation group called Embassy Protectors that prevented authorities from entering the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. for more than a month after Trump cut off relations. Zeese was interviewed on WBAI last year from inside the embassy, surrounded by feds and angry counter-protesters.
We are in the building, and 30 or more people each night are sleeping here, and we are saying we will resist. We will not voluntarily give this building over to the U.S. government or to the opposition. recognize the opposition as a legitimate government.
Zeis was involved in voter rights and transparency campaigns and started groups focused on pulling U.S. troops from Iraq. He was also working to prevent the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, peace activist Medea Benjamin.
So many things that Kevin has done so beautifully and dedicated his life to a glorious struggle. Talk about intersectionality. Nobody ever had to teach Kevin that, and we're going to miss him terribly.
What was he working on?
Oh, so many things he was working on. Support Julian Assange. He just came back from supporting a woman in Bethesda who's trying to stop the developers from taking over and building on the land that belongs to African-American cemetery. He is constantly working on issues of anti-war. He's working on so many things at once.
And that was peace activist Medea Benjamin. Zeis was an environmentalist and was a member of the Green Party. He was Ralph Nader's press secretary in 2004 and recently press secretary for Green presidential candidate Howie Hawkins.
I'm still in shock because I was communicating with him several times yesterday about different aspects of what we're doing in the campaign. He was so prolific, always putting out materials, you know, writings, going to activities. He was relentless. He was principled. He left a big wake behind him that I think it'll be hard for the progressive movement to fill. I think we're just all going to have to up our game to make up for his loss.
Any story you could illustrate the type of guy he was?
Kevin was very blunt, and some people didn't appreciate that, but I did, because we didn't agree on everything. We would argue, but I always knew he was coming from the right place. He would always respect people with a difference of opinion. That's a virtue in our politics that more of us should have.
Green Party presidential candidate Howie Hawkins. Kevin Zeis was 64. An online memorial is scheduled for September 19th. Updates are available on popularresistance.org. Kevin Zeis's partner for a decade is Dr. Margaret Flowers. She spoke with WBAI on Tuesday.
In college, he was really struck when he saw William Kunstler and Ramsey Clark come to his school. He was inspired to go to a anti-racist protest in Boston. At that protest, he was working security, and he was beaten by police on horseback. And so he really saw that kind of injustice. And then in a law school, he interned for NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and his first task there was responding to prisoner letters. And so he really saw up close and personal what, you know, the drug war, what mass incarceration do to people and their families. And so he went to work for NORML right out of that, and then went from there to become a real leader in the whole drug policy and anti-drug war movement. And another thing that was so important to him was raising up new leaders, always working with people who were interested in getting involved and supporting them in any way that he could. My time with Kevin over the last 10 years was just really remarkable because we worked on so many issues together in every way, from doing media and writing to lobbying legislators to doing direct action and action training camps. Kevin did it with a way that he could reach across partisan divides and work with anybody. He could only tell the truth. He really, sometimes people didn't want to hear that and it caused a rift. He only knew how to tell the truth, but he always did it with love and with a dedication to creating a better world for everyone, not just in the United States, but just around the world.
It must have been quite a struggle working with Kurt Schmoke to bring needle exchange and things like that to Baltimore. It was a lot of resistance, I remember.
He worked with Kurt Schmoke on harm reduction, and they were doing needle exchange before it was legal to do that. Kevin believed very strongly in harm reduction, and up until the day he died, this was an issue that he tried to educate people about and push.
The other thing I wanted to ask was about Venezuela embassy.
We stayed in the Venezuelan embassy last spring for 37 days when the U.S. was trying to conduct a coup against the democratically elected government of Venezuela and install this person who was really just a tool of Washington Clinton and a neoliberal who wanted to return Venezuela to the days when corporations could profit and people were poor. And so we stayed in that embassy and with the permission of the elected government until eventually after 37 days, law enforcement violated the Vienna Convention, entered the building illegally and arrested us. We were then charged with federal charges and went through that procedure, went to trial in February, and it was a mistrial. The jury was not able to convict us. It was a cause that he cared deeply about, and he was willing to put his body on the line to do it and to risk arrest, but we knew that we had to hang in there because what we were fighting for was so much bigger than we were.
How did you two meet?
We actually met when I held a progressive festival at a farm where I was living in northern Baltimore back in 2005. Kevin was one of the people I invited to speak. He was working on fair elections at that point, and we just kept in touch after that. He was a great mentor to me, just as he was to everybody. He was willing to answer my questions, my emails, and then we worked very closely. In 2009, 2010, during the fight for health reform, we were pushing to get a single-payer system, at least to be debated in Congress. They were trying to shut us out.
What happens next?
We are holding an online tribute to Kevin on Saturday, September 19th at 3 p.m. Eastern, and people can register for that. The link is bit.ly/ Kevin Zeese with a capital K and a capital Z. So that's bit.ly/Kevin Zeese. And we're setting up a fund which his sons would like to be able to sponsor future activists because their father cared so deeply about creating the next generation of activists. He saw that as a prime responsibility of movement leaders.
Peace activist Dr. Margaret Flowers. The online tribute is happening on Saturday, September 19th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Register at bit.ly/Kevin Zeese, capital K, capital Z. And President Trump is still reeling from revelations in the Atlantic President Trump is still reeling from revelations in the Atlantic magazine written by reporter Jeffrey Goldberg. The article claims Trump used vulgar language towards soldiers and veterans, calling them losers, and avoided a trip to a World War I cemetery where thousands of American troops are buried because he didn't want to muss up his hair. Many of the allegations against Trump have since been confirmed by other reporters, including on Fox News. Trump responded.
They'd be ashamed of themselves. But Biden shipped away our jobs, threw open our borders, and sent our youth to fight in these crazy endless wars. And it's one of the reasons the military, I'm not saying the military is in love with me, the soldiers are. The top people in the Pentagon probably aren't, because they want to do nothing but fight wars so that all of those wonderful companies that make the bombs and make the planes and make everything else stay happy. I said, that's good. Let's bring our soldiers back home. Some people don't like to come home.
And that is Donald Trump speaking in response to the Atlantic magazine article that said that he had used vulgar language against soldiers and veterans. A retired Army major and progressive activist, Danny Surgeon, is the author of a book related that was just released today. It's titled Patriotic Descent. He says it starts with the will for adventure and deep patriotic feelings, but often ends in disillusionment.
I think I was motivated partly by the desire to sort of travel and do something different, and then also pretty intense patriotism at the time in the classic sense, and believed in the wars after 9/11, although I came to change my views on those positions.
Did you see action? Did you see people get killed on both sides? Did you escape death? Did you see people escape death? Did you see all the derring do that war is all about and experience those kind of horrors?
Yeah, unfortunately I did in both wars. 8 soldiers who were directly under my command were killed. A few dozen were wounded, including amputees, and really countless local deaths, either by our hand or each other's in the Iraqi Civil War. So a lot of combat, a lot of horror, pretty serious stuff, unfortunately, that I was party to.
You're aware of all the various things that were reported from multiple sources that Trump said. It was sort of strange to hear that kind of stuff from him. What's going on with this?
Not everything he says is always wrong, and had he any principles behind it from an anti-war perspective, then it might be something we could discuss. But unfortunately, I think this is completely in line with his paltry character. with his transactional view of the world and inability to imagine sacrifice for any cause besides money and professional advancement. This is very much in line with the way he has spoken about war since Vietnam, but especially in public service, beginning with his comments about John McCain being a loser and he prefers guys that didn't get captured, including saying that, you know, avoiding sexually transmitted diseases was his personal Vietnam, but that he would like a Purple Heart someday without having to earn it.
Have you ever met anybody like that?
No, frankly, I have not, and certainly didn't imagine that that individual would become president. This is a man who appears to wear his insecurity atop his head as though it were his actual toupee. I mean, frankly, the guy's inability to see or empathize with other people, really see them, whether they're soldiers or anybody in the streets or struggling in any way, seems to personify his personality, really.
You see a lot of people who go off with high ideals and they come back broken in their sense of patriotism, like you were saying earlier. What is that process? What happens?
There's a long tradition of military skepticism and then outright military dissent ever since the American Revolution, frankly. It's a difficult sort of soul-searching process, every both intellectual and kind of ethical development. And so for me, it started in Iraq and seeing a gap between what the rhetoric said we were there to do versus what was actually happening and then what the potential outcomes were. So it is always a difficult journey. It is hard to give up the identity of purely patriotic military who really loves being adulated. But I think that in the interest of integrity and what's best for the Republic, it would be obscene not to speak out. However, that doesn't mean that one denigrates the general service of the people that they used to work with or others that choose to serve. It's more about making sure we only use the soldiers when they're needed and that the best way to support veterans is to, of course, create less of them. I'm not sure Trump could understand any of that in any real sense.
What advice should Joe Biden or what lessons should Joe Biden take from this?
Certainly, I'd like to see Joe Biden, of course, not say these things. I don't think he would do that anyway. What I think the real lesson here, though, is that I want Joe to take a systemic critique and not just fall back on thanks for your service and business as usual with our veterans, because he may not criticize them directly in the coarse way that Trump does, but misusing them but also thanking them is still an obscenity. It is still inappropriate. So I hope that he takes a broader view of what it means to serve and be served.
Retired Army Major and progressive activist Danny Surgeon. He's the author of Patriotic Dissent, America in the Age of Endless War, released today by Heyday Books. And an American lawyer and former government official who served as the White House Deputy National Security Advisor, serving in Barack Obama's administration, Avril Haines, would probably be in line to become President Joe Biden's National Security Advisor. But Jeff Kay, author of Cover Up at Guantanamo, says if Haines was chosen, it would mean more of the same, drones and targeted killings.
Avril Haines was a Obama administration official, came out of the national security apparatus where she was deputy national security advisor for the Obama administration. And she was a counselor for Obama on his drone program. She helped with the legal justifications for it and then apparently even helped him draw up the lists of who the administration could extrajudicially kill with drones. This was something the ACLU called Obama administration's drone policy really unlawful. It fell far short of the standards for transparency and accountability that you would want at all in a program like this. When the controversy around Avril Haines was kind of flying when it first came out, Samantha Power, another Obama administration official, said, well, you know, Avril Haines, if it wasn't for her, more innocent civilians would have died in the drone program. And I think that quote really perfectly captures the Democratic Party's alternative that they present to the Republicans. It's not that we won't kill innocent civilians. It's just that the other side will kill more of them. We're going to kill innocent civilians, too. We do that. It's okay, but we do a little bit better. It's a little prettier. It's a little more palatable. And that's what I said, Haines, is she makes the unpalatable palatable. And that's what the Democrats try to do. Obviously, Trump, Mike Pompeo, that whole crew, they're unpalatable. Is Biden the alternative to them? I don't think so.
What could we expect from a Biden administration as far as Guantanamo and foreign policy in general, this kind of foreign policy?
I think that you would expect pretty much what you saw with the Obama administration, although perhaps even more hawkish, because Biden is more of a hawk than Obama apparently was. We will see stepped up actions and propaganda around China. China's not the one that had a worldwide network of torture, secret torture prisons. It was the United States. April Haynes and the others, perhaps part of that same establishment.
Jeff Kay is author of Cover Up at Guantanamo. And the trial of Julian Assange in London got going this week with more threats from the U.S. government. They want Assange extradited to face a possible 175 years in prison for numerous counts of espionage. Now they're accusing him of hacking computers. This story is from RT America.
Day two began for the WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange's extradition hearing, which opened at the Old Bailey in London, with his attorney seeking the court to delay proceedings 30 minutes each day so they could confer with their client. The court is still restricting the public gallery to a handful of people. Reporters are in an adjacent room, and many are watching the trial through a live feed on their computers. A camera positioned to face the judge and the attorneys just once scanned over to show us Assange. A predicament for Assange's defense has been the restrictions enforced by Belmarsh Prison and the coronavirus lockdown. They've had little time with their client, a point that was demonstrated today by Assange during witness testimony when he suddenly yelled, "This is nonsense." That resulted in an admonishment from Judge Vanessa Barrista, who warned him he would be removed from court if he made another outburst. The court heard from two defense witnesses, Clifford Stafford Smith, who founded Reprieve, who had relied on WikiLeaks documents to defend his clients in Guantanamo, and said the documents were crucial to preparing his defense and exposing torture and war crimes and rendition. There are three cases pending before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. On cross-examination, the US prosecutor James Lewis said Assange wasn't being prosecuted for any of the WikiLeaks publications mentioned in Smith's testimony. Smith disagreed, and Lewis said he was only being prosecuted with revealing the names of informants in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other countries. This very point was misleading, however. It was the Guardian newspaper who published those documents and mistakenly gave readers the key to access the documents with the unredacted names. In the afternoon, the court heard the rest of the testimony from Professor Mark Feldstein, who argued about the close involvement journalists have with their sources and the pressure they can exert on them to request backup documents for statements they make. He told the court that no publisher had been prosecuted before, but several presidents had tried. He mentioned the story of Richard Nixon, who wanted to prosecute Jack Anderson, a columnist for the Washington Post, but was stopped by his attorney because of potential violations of the First Amendment. If extradition is granted by the court and Assange's defense fails on appeal and he's extradited to the U.S. to face, if convicted, he could face 175 years in jail. Rebecca Miles, WBAI Radio News, New York.
And journalist Kevin Gostzola is managing editor of Shadowproof.com. He's been following the case of Julian Assange.
This proceeding that's happening right now is the trial portion of Julian Assange's extradition case. His defense is calling witnesses and putting them on the stand to challenge the U.S.'s request to extradite and put him on trial for 18 charges in total. He's accused of violating the Espionage Act for 17 of those charges. This is going to go on for about 3 to 4 weeks. Numerous people who are going to be called to take the stand. Daniel Ellsberg, the Pentagon Papers whistleblower, is expected to take the stand. I understand Noam Chomsky, a very famous academic scholar, is expected to be called. So this is a crucial part of collecting evidence from witnesses that is unfolding right now.
Did they drop some new charges on him suddenly?
What there are fresh allegations in a third indictment that was issued back in August as part of a fresh extradition request. There's a press release that came out on June 24th that let the defense know that abruptly the prosecutors were choosing to add new details to the indictment. They are suggesting that there's more evidence out there that Julian Assange conspired to participate and help hackers in order to purloin information that WikiLeaks could then publish. Defense has had no opportunity to prepare for this part of the case. It's the first time in the last few months that they've been made aware that the Justice Department was going to go after Assange for any of this alleged conduct.
Does this involve Chelsea Manning?
No, that's what's remarkable about it, is it starts to depart from the core of the allegation. What the defense feels like is the prosecutors are setting this up. If the judge doesn't buy that crimes were committed when WikiLeaks published Chelsea Manning's materials, they might be able to look at two general charges that have been brought. There's a conspiracy to release classified information. There's also a conspiracy charge to commit computer crimes under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. This may indicate that the U.S. Justice Department sees that their case is weak, and they may need these other charges to salvage it if the judge doesn't feel that crimes were committed when Chelsea Manning disclosed information to WikiLeaks.
Presenting regular crimes rather than politically charged ones.
The press freedom groups out there, the human rights organizations, we've had doctors groups, we've had people throughout the world raising alarm that the charges brought against Julian Assange seem to be unprecedented. Charging a publisher has never happened in this way before in the United States. It seems to obviously undermine the First Amendment. So the U.S. Justice Department might be looking for ways to get around that.
What comes next?
After they have this 3-week extradition hearing, I understand that we would be looking for a ruling sometime soon to find out if Judge Vanessa Beretzer with the magistrate court, if she decides that this extradition should proceed.
And how is he doing?
He's engaged in the proceedings, and that would be an improvement from back in February because it was very difficult for him to follow. He even made a request to the judge to be allowed to sit with his legal team because he could not hear the proceedings from this glass box that's in the back of the UK court. We don't have this in the United States, but they put defendants in this glass container type thing that oftentimes it's hard to hear what's going on in the court, and you can't have conversations with your lawyers during the proceedings if you are confused or if you want to ask them to raise a particular issue with a witness or so on.
So he's not in a glass box anymore.
Actually, he is. He's still in the back, but because of the way the court is built, it's better acoustics so he can hear, I think.
And that's journalist Kevin Gassola. He's the managing editor of Shadowproof.com. And that's the news for Tuesday, September 8th, 2020. The news is produced Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News. Thanks for listening.